The first point to note about Simeon is that John uses it in a way very different from that of the synoptists. Actually, he uses it more also. He uses it 17 times, Matthew 13, Mark 7, Luke 11, so that he uses it considerably more frequently. But there is a very significant difference in the way it is used, quite apart from the number of times it is used. The number of times indicates it's an important concept for the fourth evangelist, but in the earlier Gospels, it is never used of Jesus' miracles. In the fourth Gospel, it is almost invariably used of those miracles. Matthew uses it, Matthew 26:48, for instance, of Judas's kiss. But the traitor had given them a sign, Simeon, saying, "Whomsoever I shall kiss, the same is he." And in Matthew 24:30, the sign of the Son of Man. Mark 13:4, similar thing. Luke 11:29, it's used as an example of the kind of sign that the Jews asked and which Jesus refused to give. So this is the kind of way in which the expression is used in the synoptists. It's very different from anything that we see in John. John normally uses it of the miracles of Jesus, but not quite invariably. Might be worth drawing our attention to what I have on page 685, footnote 68, from William Barclay. Barclay points out, in any miracle, there are three things. There is the wonder, which leaves men dazzled, astonished, aghast. That is teres. Then there is the power which is effective, which can deal with and mend a broken body, an unhinged mind, a bruised heart, a power which can do things. That will be a dunamis, which the synoptists normally use of Jesus' miracles. There is the sign which tells us of the love in the heart of God who does such things for men. And that is Simeon, which matters to John. Simeon, of course, points to that which is significant. A sign is done. So that when he uses this expression, he is always drawing our attention to the meaning in the miracles. He doesn't always use it, as I said, of Jesus' miracles. He uses it, generally speaking, but not always. I draw your attention, for instance, to John 10:41, where it is used with reference to John Baptist. And he came to him and was saying, "John did no sign, but all things that John spoke about this man were true." I cannot forbear from taking a moment or two to point out that that's not a bad thing to say about a man anyway. All through the history of the Christian church, people have been demanding miracles of God's people. You just think of what's required in a pastor, for instance, or for that matter, in a seminary professor. If you're going to fulfill the expectations that are made of you, you're going to be a miracle worker. Well, the chances are that you won't. John did no sign. But of John, it could be said, all things that John spoke about this man were true. And if that can be the epitaph of any of us, it's not a bad epitaph. It's a great thing when, though we don't live up to what men expect of us, they are driven to say he gave a true picture of Christ. That is one way in which we have this word Simeon used. For the rest, let me draw your attention to the fact that it is used by the opponents of Jesus, by Jesus himself, and by the evangelist. And let's look at them in order. The opponents of Jesus use it back in chapter 2, verse 18. And this is going to be useful for an understanding of John's method. This is after the cleansing of the temple. And the Jews answered, "What sign do you show us that you do these things?" If a man is going to drive traders and cattle and so forth out of a temple, then this is claiming, they thought, an authority of a very high kind. Now, how can you accredit yourself? What is the sign that you show us that you are able to do these things? And Jesus' reply was, "Loose this shrine, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again." And the Jews said, "With 46 years this sanctuary was building, and you in 3 days will raise it?" But he was speaking about the shrine or the temple of his body. When he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said these things, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus said. So the Jews are looking for some kind of miracle that would accredit him and would indicate that he did indeed have the authority to act in the temple as he did. And Jesus' reply is that that's not the way it's going to be at all. When they destroy his body, he will raise it up. And that is the sign that he will provide. He was speaking, John tells us, about the temple of his body. He used the word naos here, the shrine, the sanctuary. And he also tells us that the disciples didn't get it at that point, but it was when he was raised from the dead that they saw the significance of it. They remembered what he had said, and they believed both scripture and the word which Jesus had said. So that John is not saying that the disciples got the whole point of everything that Jesus said straight away. For some of the things, they had to wait until after the crucifixion and resurrection, and only then did they see the significance. This happens 2 or 3 times in John's Gospel. There is that about Jesus which could not be fully understood until the conclusion. Notice further that there is a centrality attaching to the death and resurrection of Jesus. It is by what happens then that Jesus will be accredited. Doesn't mean that the opponents of Jesus will be convinced. And John never suggests that this will happen. But he is saying that those who wish to see by what authority Jesus does things like cleanse the temple, those who sincerely are trying to find this out and are committing themselves to the way of God, they will know in the light of the atoning work that Christ will do. Now, this is important for John's method. This is the way he is writing. The cross is quite central to his understanding of things, and it is that which gives the necessary illumination which enables believers to enter into an understanding of what God is doing through Jesus. A second place where the opponents of Jesus use the expression is in chapter 6. This is very curious because in chapter 6 we have the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water, and then the discourse on the bread of life, and in the course of that discourse, on verse 30, they said to him, therefore, "What sign do you do, so that we may see and believe you? What do you work? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness. As it stands written, bread from heaven he gave them to eat." It is curious that they should ask that question. They had just seen one sign. Jesus had fed 5,000 people with a small number of loaves and fishes. And that ought to have convinced them. But they didn't. I guess they had their mind fixed on the manna, and of course there was a Jewish expectation at the time that when the Messiah came, the miracle of the manna would be renewed. And I guess that they could make a big deal out of the difference between the manna and the feeding of the 5,000. After all, Jesus only fed 5,000. Moses fed a whole nation. He did it once. Moses did it for 40 years. He gave them ordinary bread, and goodness only knows what fantasies they had about the kind of food that manna was. So that you can see how they could reason that that this feeding of the 5,000 was no big deal. But they are looking for some further act of accreditation which would put him in the class of Moses. The You is emphatic. What sign do you do, Sue, so that we may see and believe? A third occasion when such people use the expression is in the next chapter, chapter 7, verse 31. Where a hail of the crowd, many believed on him and were saying, "The Christ, when he comes, will he do more signs than those which this man does?" This is perhaps not the profoundest of faith, but it appears to rest on the miracles. It's a faith which is real anyhow. They believed on him, epistus and eisauton. And they asked the question, "The Christ, whenever he comes, will he do more miracles, more signs than this man does?" Notice that they're not completely convinced about him being the Christ when he comes, which of course could be understood as this man must be the Christ because we can't expect the Christ to do more than this. But it could be understood the other way too. And their question is introduced by May. They don't expect more signs than this. And so I guess the thrust of it is this man must be the Christ because of the number of signs that he does. And so this leads them into some kind of faith. And the fourth occasion is in chapter 11 and verse 47. High priests and the Pharisees gathered a council, and they were saying, "What are we doing? Because this man does many signs. We let him alone, all will believe on him, and the Romans will come and take away our place and nation," and so forth. This is very illuminating. See, earlier on, the Jews had asked what sign Jesus did, chapter 2, "What sign do you do," chapter 6. They were professing anyway that if he had sufficient accreditation, they would believe him. Now, in chapter 11, it doesn't matter what accreditation he's got. They agree that he's doing many signs. There's no question of lack of signs here. There's no question either that this is carrying no conviction to the high priests and the Pharisees. They are determined to get rid of him. The trouble with the signs is there are too many of them. People are going to believe if this carries on, so the thing to do is to get rid of him altogether. And in between those, we have that one example of the signs bringing about faith. There were some people who believed on him in chapter 7 on the basis that they couldn't expect the Christ to do more miracles than he did. Well, that's the way the opponents of Jesus use the expression in John. You see, it's an accrediting, attesting thing, a miraculous happening of some kind, one which would show the man who does it to be in a special relationship to God. Jesus himself uses the word semion twice in this gospel. The first time is in chapter 4, verse 48, the time when Jesus is dealing with the problem posed by the illness of the nobleman's son. And he said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." 4:48. And that leads the royal official to say to him, "Sir, come down before my little fellow dies." And Jesus said, "On your way, your son lives." It looks as though this is not an expression addressed particularly to the man. He uses the plural, except you see ideta, plural, signs and wonders you will not believe, pistus seta. It looks as if it's addressed to people at large. In general, the kind of people that were there would not believe without some spectacular happening. This fits in with the destroy this temple thing. What sign do you do in chapter 6, verse 30? So that there was this continual looking for some attesting sign. Paul maintained that this was characteristic of the Jews. The Jews seek a sign. Greeks seek wisdom. And this is the way it looks here. And then Jesus proceeded to work a sign. Then he used the expression in chapter 6 and verse 26. This is in the the discourse on the bread of life. Jesus replied, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled, were sated." I think this means that Jesus welcomed the faith that comes on the basis of the signs. It's not the highest kind of faith in John, but it is better than no faith at all. It's like the people in chapter 7, verse 31. When the Christ comes, we do more miracles than this man. It's better to come on that basis than not to come at all. And so here, Jesus is complaining that the people who are there talking to him and listening to him are there not because they saw the signs and correctly interpreted them as divine attestation. They're there because they had a good meal. I think I put it in my commentary that they were moved by full bellies rather than full hearts. They were materialistic. That was why they were there. They hadn't understood the meaning. They saw the outward thing, but they didn't see the spiritual significance of what was done, and so they didn't enter into faith. This is a little bit like we see in the synoptic, isn't it? Where we have the parables as something which people could just listen to as a beautiful story and get no place. But they could think hard about it and enter into spiritual truth. It's a Johannine equivalent with John as with the synoptists. It is quite possible to have an easy, careless adherence to Christ that doesn't go deep. While other people in the same situation can have a very real faith. Well, it's interesting that John has Jesus use the word semion twice only. All the rest, I think, come in John's account of what Jesus did. But he certainly uses the term quite frequently and in a very significant way. As you will know, a number of commentators suggest that the essential part of the gospel could be called the Book of Signs, the essential part of the public ministry. I mean, from the beginning of chapter 2 to chapter 12, it's frequently called the Book of Signs. This is a place where Jesus works all his signs, and none before chapter 2, none after chapter 12, none after chapter 11, as a matter of fact. But the signs are very important in this area. And so there are quite a number of scholars, as I say, who see signs as characteristic of this. I'm not sure that that's completely justified, because in this area we have not only the signs, but we also have the discourses. There appear to be seven signs and seven discourses, and they're intertwined. They don't follow a regular pattern. You can't say sign, discourse, or discourse, sign. Sometimes you have two signs and sometimes you have two discourses. So that they are mixed up in John's way, not ours. He doesn't use semion of all of them. He doesn't use semion of the man who was lame and was healed at the pool Bethesda in chapter 5, nor does he use it of the walking on the water in chapter 6. But he does use it of a number of others, and it will be instructive to pay attention to some of the things he says. Let us look at chapter 2, where the first sign was wrought, namely the changing of the water into wine. In verse 11, he says, "This Jesus did as a beginning of the signs in Cana of Galilee, and he manifested his glory, and his disciples believed on him." On this occasion, we have a very meaningful happening. Water pots which were set there, we are told in verse 6, were according to the purification of the Jews, so that they were required for the ordinary ceremonial rites. As you know, the Jews could not eat with defiled hands, and to remove defilement, it was necessary that somebody should pour water. You couldn't remove defilement by washing hands as we very often do, by washing in a basin or a dish or something of that kind. The hands were held out and a slave poured water so that the water ran off the hand, so to speak, taking the defilement withered. And there had to be a lot of water, because a feast would go on and on. You could have a wedding feast lasting as much as 7 days, so that with people eating and then going off and having a yarn and then coming back and eating again, you needed a lot of water, and that's why we have these six large water pots. Now, they were there for Jewish purification, and it is this Jewish purification water which is transformed into wine. And John describes this as a semion. This is a significant happening. And surely what he is telling us is that Christ came to transform what you might call the water of Judaism into the wine of the gospel. There is a richness, a fullness, a flavor about the gospel that we do not find in the formal Judaism of the day. It's John's equivalent of the synoptic teaching that Jesus didn't come to sew a patch on an old garment to pour new wine into old wine bottles. This is a radical new beginning. And this first miracle that John records is one which emphasizes the newness of what Jesus is doing and the importance of it. His second sign is in chapter 4. We were looking at that, the healing of the nobleman's son, the end of the chapter, verse 46 on. And in verse 54, we read, "This again Jesus did, a second sign, having come out of Judea into Galilee." And this presents us with a little problem, because in chapter 2:23, John has written, as therefore he was in Jerusalem in the Passover and the feast, many believed on his name, having seen the signs which he was doing. Well, not having seen his presence, seeing the signs which he was doing. So that there is a reference to a number of signs there. And there are also reference to signs in chapter 3, with Nicodemus coming to Jesus in verse 2 and saying, "Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for nobody can do these signs which you do except God be with him." So then in those two places, there is a reference to signs in the plural. John has recorded that Jesus did a number of signs, though in fact he has described only one of them, the changing of water into wine. And then to call this one the second one is a little problem. The way it is solved by a number of people is to say that John is incorporating into his gospel an earlier document which was simply a signs narrative, and in chapter 4 he has the second one. But John is doing it in a kind of a wooden manner, and so although it is not the second sign in his count, he's got the plural in 2:23 and the plural in 3:2, he simply copies this one in and makes it the second sign which Jesus did. There are problems there. You may want to discuss this a little more fully when we come to the question time, but I would simply point out in passing that this postulates the kind of book that we have no reason whatever for believing ever existed, namely a book which pictured Jesus as a miracle worker, a wonder worker, a thaumaturge. All the books that we have about Jesus insist that he taught, that he was a person that taught people plainly about the things of God. And in this section of John's Gospel, where the word semion is used and where there are six or seven miracles, there are an equivalent number of discourses in which important teaching is given about God. And I find it very difficult to think that any informed early Christian, anybody knew enough about Jesus to want to write a book about him, would simply depict him as a miracle worker. That wasn't the way he appeared. There were miracle workers. Yeah, they wandered around in antiquity and all sorts of places. I guess that on the whole we would class them with conjurers today. The quickness of the hand deceives the eye. I mean, you see the top hat and there's nothing in it, and then the guy pulls a rabbit out. It's a miracle. One cannot explain how it happened. And there were people who made a good living out of being religious and doing this sort of thing. And there are books about religious characters who did this sort of thing. But as I say, I don't see any evidence that any Christian ever thought of Jesus like that. Always his teaching is important. So I find that a problem. I also find a problem, of course, with John 4:54. Doesn't fit very easily into a situation where he has already spoken of signs in the plural. But I think that perhaps we should take with great seriousness the having come out of Judea into Galilee. That's what he did in chapter 2. He came out of Judea into Galilee and worked a sign. Now, we don't know where he was. He worked the signs in 2:23 and in 3:2. He's in Jerusalem at the time of the word is spoken in Jerusalem. But this time he's come out of Judea into Galilee again and worked a sign. So I think that probably the explanation is that this is the second time he did a sign just when he came to Galilee after being in Jerusalem. But it's not an easy expression. However, we know that that is the second one. Now this sign is connected with the giving of life. And the boy was at the point of death, and Jesus gave life. Sometimes we miss this in our translations. For instance, in verse 50, Jesus says to him, "Poriou, on your way, your son lives." And a number of translations render this, "Your son is going to live." Make it a prophecy of the outcome of the disease. But this seems to me to miss the point that hohiosu te is a word of power. Jesus spoke a healing word, and the son was healed. Notice how he repeats that in verse 51, hopais autou ze, and we get it again in verse 53, hohiosu te. Little alterations, quite in the characteristic Johannine manner, but with this powerful word of living mentioned on each occasion, so that Jesus is depicted here as the powerful life giver, and the sign that he does, rescuing a boy at a distance from the point of death, is the action of one who brings life into the world. We find a further reference to the sign in chapter 6. In verse 2, a great crowd was following Jesus because they were seeing the signs which he was doing on those that were sick. So that there is the picture there of somebody who did a lot of signs. And then at the end of the miracle, in verse 14, the men, therefore, having seen the sign which he did, were saying, "This is truly the prophet who comes into the world." So that the reference to Simeon in verse 14 makes it clear that the feeding of the 5,000 is regarded as a sign. It is a significant happening. It represents the fulfilling of a bodily need, but represents also an important spiritual lesson. In this one, I think we have a good example of the way John's teaching and signs go in, because we have at the opening of the chapter the feeding of the multitude, and then the discourse on the bread of life. Jesus gives people bread which enables them to live, and he is the bread which enables people to live. So that there is both the physical giving of bread and the spiritual giving of bread all tied up in the one chapter as we divide up the text. And that is, as I say, a very good way, example of the way in which a sign can be seen to be a significant thing. It emphasizes the importance of Jesus as the giver of the bread of life. There is a reference in chapter 9 to the man born blind, which I think should be taken in the same way. Chapter 9, the word sign occurs in verse 16. Some of the Pharisees were saying, "This man is not from God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath." But others were saying, "How can a sinner man do such signs?" And there was a schism, a division among them. The word is plural, and we have "such" qualifying it, but I think it is fair to say that the use of "such" signs when they're discussing this miracle indicates that they understood this miracle as a sign. And of course John understood it as such when he recorded these words as being used of this happening. What we have here then is the giving of sight to a blind man, and the emphasis on this as unusual. What we have here then is the giving of sight to a blind man, and the emphasis on this as unusual. This hadn't happened before in the history of the world, according to the man born blind, and so far as we know, this was so. There are no references in the Old Testament or in other literature that we know of to the giving of sight to somebody who had been born without sight. So that this is regarded as a very significant thing. A man with no native sight is given sight by Jesus. This has to be understood in conjunction with the discourse on the light of the world. In the preceding chapter, chapter 8, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," so that we have both the sign and the teaching. The happening is a significant happening, and it drives home the point that what Jesus is doing is significant. The miracle brings it out. It is possible we should say the same thing about Lazarus, chapter 11, verse 47. Chief priests and Pharisees gathered a council and were saying, "What are we doing? Because this man does many signs." The point there is that this follows immediately on the fact that verse 46, some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus had done, i.e. raised Lazarus. I think it would be hypercriticism to doubt that John wants us to see semion here as applying to the raising of Lazarus. He doesn't actually say this is a semion, but the fact that the account of this being brought to the Pharisees leads them to complain about the signs Jesus was doing, I think indicates that. Well, now that indicates that semion is definitely used of three of Jesus' miracles, probably, my judgment almost certainly, of two more, making five. It is not applied to two of them. Not applied to the lame man in chapter 5. This man had been there by the pool Bethesda, you recall, 38 years. And Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be healed?" And the man didn't really reply to that. He said, "Sir, I don't have any man that when the water is troubled will toss me into the pool. But while I'm coming, somebody else gets down before me." And Jesus says, "Rise, take up your pallet and walk." And immediately the man became healthy and he lifted up his pallet and was on his way. This is not immediately related to the discourse which follows on the nature of the sonship and the witness which is born to him, but it looks as though this is the kind of thing that John would understand as a sign. Don't see how else we can fit it in. So that even though the word semion is not specifically used of it, it looks like his method. The other one is more difficult. In chapter 6, there isn't any question that we have the feeding of the 5,000 as a sign. We looked at that before. But then we have the walking on the water. And as you will know, there is dispute among the pundits here as to whether this is depicted as a miracle or not. The critical question is the meaning of verse 19, when they'd wrote about 25 or 30 stadia, they see Jesus walking epitestelestes and being near the boat. Traditionally, that has been taken as indicating walking upon the lake, walking on the surface of it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. You get the identical expression over in chapter 21, Verse 1, after these things, Jesus manifested himself to the disciples, epites thalassais, by the lake of Galilee, by the lake of Tiberias. So that the word does not necessarily mean on, it can mean beside. But on the other hand, it doesn't necessarily mean beside either. It can mean upon. And in Mark's account of the walking on the water, this is the expression which is used. So that on the whole, it looks to me as though John is narrating a further miracle, or one of walking on the water. It could be that, well, I think it has to be, because why would the disciples be afraid, as we're told at the end of verse 19, if in fact they were so close to the shore that they could see Jesus walking on the shore? It's suggested that they were scared out of their wits and that they didn't know what was going on. But these were people who were familiar with the Lake of Galilee. They'd been professional fishermen there. They'd earned their living there. And they would surely not have been scared when they were so close to deliverance as that. So that I would incline to think that this is a further sign, even though the term sign is not used of it. And while I recognize that there are some scholars who would think that there isn't a miracle here at all, if this is not a sign, then we have six signs in the gospel, which is not the kind of number that one would have anticipated. Well, there it is. John has this group of happenings, some of which he calls a sign, and in each case we can see something of the meaning, the transformation of the water of Judaism into the wine of the gospel, the giving of life to the person at the point of death, the giving of health to the person whose life was grievously handicapped, and in 5, the giving of food, the bread of life, to the people who were in need, the giving of sight to the blind, the giving of life to the dead. All of these point us to important aspects of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And these are things that matter immensely in the teaching of this fourth gospel. Now let us notice some of the things that resulted from the signs. We've already noticed one or two of them. We noticed in chapter 6, verse 2, for instance, that many people followed Jesus, because they had seen the signs that he was doing on the ill. With that, I guess we should put chapter 12, verse 18. Crowd met him, because they'd heard that he'd done this sign, so that people went out to meet him on the basis of a sign that they had heard that he had done. In this case, the sign was the raising of Lazarus. It impressed them. They wanted to see him. They went out and met him. Nicodemus, chapter 3 and verse 2, maintained that the signs indicated that God was with Jesus. No man can do these signs that you do except God be with him. And I think John will want us to see this too. The signs are significant of the divine presence with Jesus. We've already noticed in chapter 2:23 that people believed on his name because of the signs, so that there are passages where the signs result in faith. We also saw earlier that this is not the highest kind of faith, but Jesus accepted it. Chapter 6:26, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you were filled, where the signs would have been an acceptable method of approach. But with this lot, we should add the point that seeing the signs is not automatically a product of a producer of faith. Chapter 12, verse 37, John is rounding off the public ministry of Jesus. And he says, though he had done so many signs before them, they didn't believe on him, so that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who believed our report, and so forth. For this reason, verse 39, they couldn't believe, because, again, Isaiah said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, and so forth. 41, these things Isaiah said because he saw his glory. Incidentally, that bit reinforces what we were seeing in our earlier one, because the words of Isaiah refer to rejection. He's blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see and understand, and I should heal them. So that it is in the rejection that Isaiah saw his glory. Now, this is surely the humble glory of which Oregon spoke. But for our present purpose, the important thing is that there's nothing automatic about seeing signs and following that by faith. And John emphasizes when he comes to chapter 12 and he faces the question, why didn't the Jews accept Jesus? The answer is in the will of God. You cannot say that God was defeated by the obduracy of the Jews. This is, of course, the question that Paul wrestled with in Romans 9 to 11. And this is John's answer. You find it in prophecy. It had to be that the signs would not automatically produce faith because God spoke through Isaiah saying this and this would happen. So that the signs are evidence of God's working. They are all significant happenings. They can produce faith, but they do not necessarily produce faith. Now, one more we must look at, namely in chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31, where, of course, we have the purpose of this gospel. Therefore, many other signs Jesus did before his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So that there are many signs which Jesus did. John does not want us to have the opinion that the only signs are those six or seven that he has narrated. There are many of them. But he's made his selection, and he has written about the signs he has written about in order that you may believe, so that the signs are significant as pointing people to faith. And while there's nothing automatic about that, yet we have seen an interesting number of places where people did come to believe in some fashion on account of the signs, and John wants others of his readers to have that same experience also. Since we have faith mentioned there, and this has the purpose of the book, it may be worth drawing attention to the fact that John uses the cognate verb also. And semino, to signify, is used in this gospel three times only, always of death. It is used of the death of Jesus, chapter 12, verse 33. Now this he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. If I be lifted up on the cross, will draw him in to me, in verse 32. And this signifies how Jesus would die. And we get it again in chapter 18:32, which refers back to that. In order that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. And we have a reference to Peter's death in chapter 21:19. This he said, signifying by what death he would glorify God. I dislike overpressing biblical words, but I wonder whether the fact that this word to signify is used three times only and always in connection with death may not have its reference to the signs that John narrates, because he's writing his whole book that people may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and the significance of the death of Jesus is of central importance to the giving of life. Well, you may reject that. I just put it out as something that I think is worth consideration. One or two notes I would like to draw your attention to. On my commentary, page 687, note 72, Hoskins points out that the signs in the Bible, and supremely in John, are usually of such a kind as to anticipate and show forth the nature both of what will take place and of the work of him whom they authenticate. They are not narrated as prodigies or wonders, nor do they merely authenticate Jesus. They are quite properly signs or parables of the nature of his work. The Jews were looking for a sign that would authenticate. And what Hoskins is saying is that while the signs have some authenticating function, they do more than that. They indicate the nature of his work. They are signs or parables of the nature of his work. I mean, he gives sight to the blind. He does it literally. He also does it spiritually, and so on with others. And that, I think, is part of John's understanding. I want to use the rest of my time here actually to get off signs. You can get back onto them, of course, in the question time. The point here being that a number of writers have said that John's handling of the miracles depends very largely on his use of semion. Now, it is interesting that he does use this word so many times and that he uses it in a way that is different from that in the synoptists. But what is not so frequently noticed is that this is not, in fact, the way that John usually refers to Jesus' miracles. He calls them erga. Ergon is used in this gospel 27 times, 18 of Jesus' works, 9 times of men. And you can't get much out of the men's work, 5 times there of good works and 4 times of bad. So you can't say the word as applied to men refers either to good deeds or bad deeds. It's a pretty fair split. But the important point for our present subject is that this is Jesus' own favorite word for his miracles in John. I pointed out that he uses the word semion twice only, but he keeps on using ergon or erga, the plural. Just precisely how many times is a little hard to say, because the works of the Father and the works of the Son are mixed up. Take, for instance, a look at chapter 10, verse 37. If I don't do the works of my Father, don't believe me. But if I do, even if you don't believe me, believe the works. And verse 37, the works are specifically said to be the Father's. They're not specifically said to be the Father's in verse 38, but they're clearly the things that he does, and so they are his works. I guess they are both the works of the Father and of the Son, but that kind of passage makes it a little difficult to classify with any exactness. You get it again in chapter 14, verse 10. Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words which I speak, I don't speak of myself, but the Father dwelling in me does his works. The Father does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, but otherwise believe on account of the works themselves. Or again, you have a moving from the works specifically said to be the Father's to the works where you can only see them as the works of Jesus. Is there any question that on occasion this word is used of miracle? Chapter 7, verse 21, I'll give you that. Jesus replied, "One work I did, and you're all astonished." He's referring back to the healing of the lame man. But the astonishment at the one work clearly points us to a miracle. And I think that that is implied also in the two passages we're just looking at, where they are works of God and works of Christ. We should notice that these works are regarded as distinctive. Chapter 15, verse 24. If I hadn't done the works which nobody else did, I guess is what that one is. If the works I had not done among you which no other did, they would not have sinned, and so on. So that his works are distinctive. Nobody else did works like this ever before. But the great thing in the fourth gospel is that these works are related to the work of the Father. We've seen that in a couple of passages, and it is no great trick to dig out a whole string of others. My meat is to do the will of sent me and to complete his work. John 4:34. And when we were in our previous study in John 17, you remember John 17 verse 4, he had finished the work which the Father gave him to do. Quite a few of them there. One should note also a little reference to Revelation now and then, chapter 5, verse 36. The works which the Father gave me that I should do them, the works themselves which I do, bear witness about me that the Father sent me, so that the works bear witness. They reveal something about Jesus. And now and then, the words and the works are closely connected. Being Lutherans, you will doubtless have picked up the reference to the word in chapter 14:10 when we were looking at it, though I drew no particular attention to that. Anglicans, of course, would have missed it. Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? The words which I speak to you from myself I do not speak, but the Father dwelling in me does his works. So that the word Jesus spoke and the works the Father did in him are linked together. The word and the works go together. Now these works, I think, are important because ergon may refer to what is natural or to what is supernatural. It is difficult in all cases to be absolutely certain whether the primary thrust is to the miraculous or the non-miraculous. And I think that this is one way that John has of bringing out the truth that the life of Jesus is all of one piece. You can't divide him up saying he did these things as God and those things as men. And the works that he did may be natural, may be supernatural. Another thing that it does is to draw attention to the fact that it's natural to him to do the supernatural, if I can put it that way. What to us is a miracle, to him is no more than a work. It is the kind of thing that you would anticipate that he would do anyway. All of life of Christ's life is lived to the glory of God, and whether he's doing a miracle or doing something non-miraculous, there is God in it. I think that there has to be significance in the fact that Jesus' own word is ergon, erga, rather than semion. He only uses it a couple of times. Nonetheless, John's use of semion is a significant use. It's very different from that in the other Gospels, and it draws our attention to important teaching. I would want to add just one more thing, that the use of ergon perhaps ties up with the Old Testament emphasis on the works of God. There are the mighty works of God narrated in the Old Testament, and this use of works in John's Gospel reminds us that the action of Jesus is all of a piece with that. This fits into the pattern of God's intervention. And this, of course, is brought out also in the statement that the Father and the Son are one, John 10:30. There is a unity between Old and New Testament, between Father and Son, between the action in days of old and the action in the time of Christ. Now, this one is missed by a lot of people. Alan Richardson, for instance, I've got him on page 689, note 75, says John doesn't call the miracles dunamis, but semia. Occasionally he uses the relatively colourless word works. But he has missed out on the enormous significance of works, and he's occasionally is a beauty, isn't it? Jesus used the same ion twice in John and works quite a number of times. But you can get away with a lot if you throw in adverbs like occasionally and trust that people won't check up on you. Well, that is where I should stop, so let me stop and you can ask the questions that will put us in the right track. It is correct, and it is correct not only of John, but of all the New Testament writers. Nobody uses teras by itself of Jesus' miracles. Teras is the word which emphasizes the wonder. Now, you can't explain a teras. It is a marvelous thing. Now, this is the point that I was trying to make when I pointed out that there are no books which picture Jesus as a thaumaturge. It is not the Christian habit to think of Jesus purely as a miracle worker. His deeds are mighty. That's the dunamis that we have in the synoptics. They are significant, semaia, and they are the works of God, erga. But the teras draws attention to the fact that we can't explain them. Now, this is part of it. I don't want to give the impression, you know, that we must always keep talking about semion or dunamis or so on and forget teras. It is part of it. And it is joined with semion to indicate that there is something marvelous about the significant happenings. But I think the important thing for us to notice is that this word is never used by any New Testament writer of Jesus' miracles by itself. It always is joined with something else, usually with semaia.
Reason Fell somewhere has the statement that one of the reasons John does not have the account of the Transfiguration is that the whole Gospel is the story of Transfiguration. Care to comment on that observation?
Yes. I think this is true, but I think it has to be understood carefully. I have already made, with, I trust, some emphasis, my point that in John, glory means lowliness rather than pomp and majesty and splendor. But glory all the same. It is real glory. And that glory runs right through this gospel from start to finish. There is no place where the glory of the incarnate Son isn't revealed in lowly service. And in that sense, I agree with Riesenfeld. It would be difficult to include a narrative of transfiguration. Narrative of the transfiguration concentrates glory into one place. Now, it wouldn't be impossible to think of John as finding a place for it. He could think of the transfiguration, so to speak, as a sign of something that is there all the way through. But it is easier for my mind, anyway, to think of him as saying, well, now let's leave that one out, because in this gospel I want to bring out the continuing humble glory. And to concentrate in one passage would be maybe to throw readers off the track. I would agree with Riesenfeld.